This is the sixth day of this November 2011 seven-day session. Today we're going to take up a koan, this one from the Mumon Khan, or the Gateless Gate. And this is number 10. Sozan and Poor Seize. And the case. A monk, Seize by name, said to Master Sozan, "I am poor and alone. I beg you, Master, to please make me rich." Sozan said, "Venerable Seize." "Yes, Master," replied Seize. Sozan said, "You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine of China, but still say your lips are not yet moistened." That's the end of the case. The commentary and verse by Mumon, Master Mumon, are pretty short, so I'll read through those too. The commentary: Seize assumes an obsequious manner, but what is his real intention? Sozan, with his penetrating eye, sees through Seize's mind. Be this as it may, just tell me how the Venerable Seize could have drunk this wine. And the verse: His poverty is like Hantan's, his spirit like that of Kou. Though he can hardly sustain himself, he dares to compete with the richest of men. most of you know that the Mumon Khan is probably the most famous, well, the Mumon Khan and the Blue Cliff Record, but the Mumon Khan is a collection of koans, 48 koans that were compiled by great Zen master Mumon, who then added his own commentary and verse to each one. And we do have some biographical material about the master, this master Sozan. That's his Japanese name. The other guy, the monk, Seize, that's the only name I have in the records for him. That's also a Japanese name. So rather than having one in the Japanese version and the other original, I'll just stick to both of them in the Japanese version. So we'll keep calling his Chinese name. Sozan's Chinese, real Chinese name is Shushan. And he lived, we'll call him Sozan. We have no dates for him, but somewhere around the 9th century is when he lived. We'll be reading here from this wonderful collection of biographical material about the masters, the Chinese masters, called Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. Sozan is regarded as a disciple and a Dharma heir of Dongshan Liangjie. If that name sounds familiar, it's in our ancestral line that we chant, at least the full ancestral line that we chant outside of Sashin. Dongshan, known in his Japanese name as Tozan, was one of the co-founders of what is called the Soto sect. So he was a famous master. So he's regarded, this Sozan is regarded as a disciple and Dharma heir of Dongshan, but his search for enlightenment took him to many teachers. It's very unusual how many teachers he practiced under. He was very short in physical stature and thus earned the nickname the Dwarf Teacher. Uh, Sozan first studied with a teacher named, well, it doesn't matter. I don't want to throw too many of these names at you. So the first teacher he practiced with, one day he told him, "I'm traveling east to the capital city of Luoyang." He studied in Luoyang for less than a year. Then one day he suddenly said, "Seeking brings only darkness, and talking isn't as good as silence. Forget oneself and help others. The false can't compare to the true." Seeking brings only darkness. Well, seeking, by its very nature, finds us in a state of darkness. If we knew what it was, if we had found what we were seeking, we would no longer be in a state of darkness. So it's the nature of seeking, of the search, to be in darkness. In Roshi Kaplow's book, Zen Merging of East and West, the dedication reads, "Dedicated not to those who seek, but to those who find." But before you find, you have to seek. Some very potent statements here. The other ones, talking isn't as good as silence. Yeah, but in Zen we recognize that you don't want to get caught in silence either. You don't want to be attached to silence. So we recognize that there's a time to be silent and there's a time to speak, to respond with words. We don't want to be attached to either one of them. Forget oneself and help others. A whole book could be written on that. Books have been written on that. He then went to study under Dongshan, who we mentioned earlier. He asked Dongshan, in words not yet heard, "Please, Master, provide me instruction." Dongshan said, "I don't say people can't realize it." Sozan said, "Can it be obtained through practice or not?" Dongshan said, "Are you realizing it now through practice?" Sozan said, "Not realizing it through practice should not be avoided." I had to read this a couple times and lop off a couple negatives to get what he was saying. But this kind of language is high level Dharma combat. In Dharma combat, one is always trying to avoid being pinned to only one side of the truth. There are these two sides to reality. There's the relative side of our ordinary conventional world, and then there's the absolute, which is beyond it. There's the side of change and time and space, and that's the relative or the conventional, and then the other side is beyond time, beyond space, beyond differences. So basically all Dharma combat comes down to trying to maneuver the other one into one of those and avoid being maneuvered into it oneself. Not falling into either affirmation or negation. This question, can it be obtained through practice or not, is a loaded one. You can say that ultimately, from the absolute perspective, there's nothing that can be obtained because there's nothing we lack. Practice, then, just becomes a way to realize that there's nothing we need to obtain. Here's another exchange. On one occasion, Dongshan entered the hall and said, "I want you to understand this matter. You must be like a dead tree that blossoms flowers. Then you will merge with it." It's a wonderful expression, a dead tree that blossoms flowers. Dead in the sense of having relinquished everything. Above all, the stuff of the mind. Relinquished thoughts. Given up trafficking in the stuff of the mind. And that's when our true nature really blooms. Then you will merge with it. Sozan asked, "What about when every place is corrupted?" Dongshan said, "Your Reverence, you're talking about practicing a practice. Fortunately, there is a realm of non-practicing practice. Why don't you ask about that?" Sozan said, "Practicing a non-practicing practice? Can there be such a person?" Dongshan said, "Many people will laugh at you for asking such a question." Sozan said, "In that case, my thinking has gone astray." Dongshan said, "Astray is not astray, nor not astray." Sozan said, "What is astray?" Dongshan said, "If you say such a person, then you still don't understand." Sozan said, "What is not astray?" Dongshan said, "A place of no differentiation." We avoid going astray when we can function out of this realm of non-differentiation, out of the realm of oneness. Dongshan asked Sozan, "In the empty aeon, there is no person. Who is it who resides there?" Sozan said, "I don't know." Dongshan said, "Does that person have a thinking mind or not?" Sozan said, "Why don't you ask him?" Dongshan said, "I'm asking him right now." Sozan said, "What is this mind?" And Dongshan didn't answer. It says here in this text, Andy Ferguson's text, that there is confusion about even the barest outlines of Sozan's life and whom he trained under, when. Here's another dialogue. After Dongshan died and the mourning period for the monks had passed, Sozan went to Mount Gui in Tanzhou. There he heard Guishan address the monks, saying, Worthies who are on a pilgrimage, you must sleep in sound and form. You must sit and you must lie down in sound and form." Sozan came forward and said, "What is a phrase that does not fall into sound and form?" Guishan raised his whisk into the air. Sozan said, "This is a phrase that falls into sound and form." Guishan then lowered the whisk and went back to his quarters. Um, some people might read this last line about him going back to his quarters as a kind of a defeat. He's just slinking away, having been bested by his opponent. But you have to be very careful about any superficial interpretation of these dialogues. Then it says, Sozan felt no affinity with Guishan. Guishan, that's the original Chinese name of the master, very famous master, known by his Japanese name as Isan. Isan is the guy, for those of you who may have heard of this, the guy who kicked over the water bottle and then was appointed to be the abbot of the new monastery. That's Guishan. So, but it says Sozan felt no affinity with Guishan, and so he told Xiangyan of his intention to leave. Xiangyan asked him, "Why don't you stay here a little longer?" Sozan said, "The teacher and I do not have affinity." Xiangyan said, "Why so? Will you tell me about it?" Sozan then described the foregoing incident, the one where Guishan put down his whisk and went back to his quarters. Xiangyan said, "I have a saying." Sozan said, "What is it?" Xiangyan said, "When words emanate, there is no sound. Before form, there are no things." Sozan said, "Fundamentally, there is a person here." Sozan then said to Xiangyan, "Hereafter, if you find a place to serve as abbot, I'll come to see you there." So he apparently did feel an affinity with Xiangyan. He then said goodbye to Xiangyan. Guishan later said to Xiangyan, "Is the short worthy who asked about sound and form here?" Xiangyan said, "He's gone away." Guishan said, "Did he tell you about what he asked me?" Xiangyan said, "Yes, and I gave him an answer concerning it." Guishan asked, "What did he say?" Xiangyan said, "He deeply approved my answer." Guishan said, "I think that short disciple has some tall points. He just arrived here. In the future, if he finds a place to abide, then on that mountain there won't be firewood to burn or water to drink." What might he have meant by that? On that mountain there won't be firewood to burn or water to drink. Because there will be so many monks flocking there? Or a more profound meaning to that? Sozan heard that the teacher Guishan An of Fuzhou, part of the confusion here is that there are two masters by the name of Guishan, the famous one and another one, that this Guishan said to his congregation, "There are phrases that are not phrases. They are like a wisteria vine wound around a tree for support." So remember that, more or less, that phrase. Sozan then went into the mountains of Fuzhou to see, I won't keep giving you more names, he went to see this other guy. When he arrived, all right, Dagui was doing masonry work on a wall. Sozan said, "I've heard that you say to be with words or without words is like wisteria wound around a tree. If suddenly the tree falls and the wisteria withers, where will the words go?" Guishan burst into laughter. Sozan said, I've come 1,000 miles, even selling my belongings, to see you. Why do you make light of me, teacher? This, by the way, is this dialogue here is a koan in a later collection of koans, the Shoyoroku. Why do you make light of me, teacher? Guishan called to his attendant and said, get some money and give it to this monk for his travel expenses. Then he said, someday there will be a one-eyed dragon who will let you open your eyes. Later, Sozan went to Ming Zhao and told him about this. Ming Zhao said, we may say that Guishan was right from head to tail, but he didn't meet the one who knows. And by the way, this Ming Zhao had only one eye. So there was something to that prophecy. So Sozan asked this new guy, Ming Zhao, if the tree falls and the wisteria withers, where will the words go? Ming Zhao said, that would make Guishan laugh all the more. At these words, Sozan had an awakening. Then he said, from the first, Guishan's laughter had a sword. When Sozan was about to die, he composed the following verse. My way lies outside the blue emptiness. White clouds have no place to drift. In the world is a rootless tree, yellow leaves sent back by the wind. So that's all the material we have on this Sozan. Seizei, we have nothing on. That's the monk who comes to him and says, I am poor and alone. I beg you, Master, to please make me rich. Challenge with koans. Each koan is to be able to discern what is the meaning behind the words. One of the many values of working with these koans is that they train us. They train our eye and our ear not to be deceived by words, because, of course, as we know, many people the world over use words to deceive others. So what the student has to do in working on a koan like this is, with this statement, I am poor and alone, is to try to intuit what this seizei, this monk, is really saying. As a monk, he naturally lives a life of some poverty, so we can be sure he's not, doesn't mean this literally, I'm poor, give me some money. What about alone? What's he really saying here? These qualities, being poor and feeling poor and alone, are really qualities that we can sometimes feel in Sesshin when we are deep into our practice. There is a state we can get into in this contemplative practice of feeling utterly alone. It's one of the many crucibles of Sesshin practice. Sometimes it's too much for people. It's rare, but there have been people who just couldn't stand to be away from their spouse, their children, and who've actually rushed out of Sesshin. The loneliness is so, they feel it so acutely, being apart from the loved one, their loved ones. The truth is, in Sesshin, we are truly not apart from our loved ones. I sometimes remind people who describe a spouse who is critical of their going to Sesshin, I remind them that we go to Sesshin not just for ourselves. So many people come to benefit from our Sesshin experience. But even while we're in Sesshin, before we even go home, we are connected to people in the deepest, deepest way. To the degree that we are free of thoughts, we will be in communion with others. We will feel this intimacy with not just family and friends, but all beings. All beings, all one, alone. It's a difference between alone and lonely. By reaching into the depths of our nature in Sesshin, we can reach the point where we will never feel lonely again. So again, I beg you, Master, to please make me rich. Just let me say that in the one of the reasons I wanted to read the commentary right after reading the case at the beginning of Taisho was this statement by Mumon: Seizei assumes an obsequious manner, but what is his real intention? He's offering us a clue here, Mumon. That is, if he can be trusted. I beg you, Master, to please make me rich. Sozan said, Seizei. Yes, Master, replied Seizei. You've already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine of China, but still say your lips are not yet moistened. A later master composed a couple of lines in commenting on this exchange. The mirrors reflect the lights of the golden palace. The hills respond to the note of the moonlit tower's bell. There's a story from a collection of stories called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World, edited by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield. Let me read this story. It came to mind in delving into this koan. And this is by a Father Theophany. I am a monk myself, and the one question I really wanted to ask was, what is a monk? Well, I finally did, but for an answer, I got a most peculiar question. Do you mean in the daytime or at night? Now, what could that mean? When I didn't answer, he picked it up again. A monk, like everyone else, is a creature of contraction and expansion. During the day, he is contracted, behind his cloister walls, dressed in a habit like all the others, doing the routine things you expect a monk to do. At night, he expands. The walls cannot contain him. He moves throughout the world and he touches the stars. Ah, I thought, poetry. To bring him down to earth, I began to ask, well, during the day in his real body, wait, he said, that's the difference between us and you. You people regularly assume that the contracted state is the real body. It is real in a sense, but here we tend to start from the other end, the expanded state. The daytime state we refer to as the body of fear. And whereas you tend to judge a monk by his decorum during the day, we tend to measure a monk by the number of persons he touches at night and the number of stars. Something to consider when one is trying to decide whether to sit up during the night during Sesshin. Number of stars we touch at night. This is mind unbounded by thoughts, mind unbounded by notions of self and other, inside and outside. Xuanzi, the great Taoist, said, to the mind that is still, the universe surrenders. Commentary. Seizei assumes an obsequious manner, but what is his real intention? Obsequious is a somewhat unusual word for people who may not know it. Basically, it means a very humble, meek attitude. But what is his real intention? Sozan, with his penetrating eye, sees through Seizei's mind. Be this as it may, just tell me how the Venerable Seizei could have drunk this wine. Well, that's... here Mumon is pointing us to the nub of the koan. What did Sozan mean when he says, you've already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine of China? And now, Mumon's verse. His poverty is like Hantan's, his spirit like that of Kou. Though he can hardly sustain himself, he dares to compete with the richest of men. These references, students never know who these guys are in Doksan. I found a brief note on each one of these. Hantan, his poverty is like Hantan's. Hantan was a famous Chinese scholar who was appointed to the high post of governor. He didn't take up his post, however, but instead took care of his sickly mother. His contentment with honest poverty and his filial devotion made his name renowned. His spirit like that of Kou. Kou was a great hero in Chinese history. The commander of a large army, he fought the eventual founder of the Han dynasty and won every battle but the last. Surrounded by the enemy's forces, he sat in his tent with his beloved mistress, Gu, unmoved by the approach of death, and sang the song which afterward became famous. Strength to move mountains, spirit to cover the world, now all is lost. Sui, my horse, not yet dead. Gu, oh Gu, what should I do with you? Who's this his here? His poverty is like Hantan's, his spirit like that of Kou. Though he can hardly sustain himself. Though he can hardly sustain himself. There's an enlightenment verse that just springs to mind right now, so I'm going to mangle it a little bit. After this enlightenment, the master said, last year's poverty was not true poverty. This year's poverty, last year's poverty was not true poverty. There was still room to stand an awl upon, like a shoemaker's awl, like an ice pick. There was still room to stand an ice pick on. This year's poverty is true poverty. There isn't even room for that. He dares to compete with the richest of men. The philosopher Kant, Immanuel Kant, said, one is not rich by what one owns, but more by what one is able to do without with dignity. For those who are suited to a life of simplicity, a monk's life, the life of a person in training at the center, living at the center, any center. The simplicity of having so little is really a wonderful freedom. If you're ready for it, if you're suited to it, it is a tremendous gift. The ultimate richness, spiritually, is an empty mind, which means a mind of purity and openness and wonder, unencumbered by things, above all by thoughts, but as we know, things, possessions, have a way of generating a lot of thoughts, a lot of worries, a lot of anxiety, a lot of concerns. There's another little story, this one from the Sufi tradition, about the featuring the famous Nasruddin. Nasruddin was eating a poor man's diet of chickpeas and bread. His neighbor, who also claimed to be a wise man, was living in a grand house and dining on sumptuous meals provided by the emperor himself. His neighbor told Nasruddin, "If only you would learn to flatter the emperor and be subservient like I do, you would not have to live on chickpeas and bread." Nasruddin replied, "And if only you would learn to live on chickpeas and bread like I do, you would not have to flatter and live subservient to the emperor." The Zen masters of ancient times distinguished themselves often by refusing to get involved in the imperial court. Some of them did. Some of them were invited to become what they called the national teacher, where they had to reside at the court and be available for the emperor's spiritual guidance. And I'm guessing that sometimes the emperor made them an offer they couldn't refuse. But others, it seems most of them, they had the good sense not to get involved in the politics and the intrigue and all of the complications of that kind of station, that world of the court. They would recognize that they wouldn't be able to live in the same with the same simplicity, and that always means that the mind would be more complicated. To say it again, as we did earlier in Sesshin, things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. Often we think of the first part of that. Things are things because of mind, but there's the second part. Our mind is determined very much by our surroundings. There's no better way to simplify the mind than to simplify our surroundings. We know this from a week of Sesshin. Look at how simple it all becomes when we are freed of having to make decisions, having other responsibilities. Of course, parents, especially parents of young children, don't have the luxury of relinquishing everything and finding that kind of simplicity. But the real point is the mind, simplifying the mind, to find time every day to sit is to experience the richness of this mind of simplicity. One more quote that I think is so profound. This is actually from William Morris, the theatrical agent, the American theatrical agent. He said, "Simplicity of life, even the barest, is not misery, but the very foundation of refinement." Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.